Redacted Media and GhostHat.net present The Film Illogical Society. On today's episode, we continue our countdown of the BBC's 100 Greatest Comedies of All Time. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Scholes and Chad Halverson.
All right, and welcome to another edition, another episode, really, of the Filmological Society, the countdown show, where we are, if you believe it or not, we are a number 90. Number 90.
Well, out of 100.
Out of 100, technically 101, because they slipped in an extra one there.
And oh yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong, we're like 90, or we're like 10-11% through this list?
Yeah, like 10.5, I think it would be, because there's 101 movies out of a top 100 list, and we are 11 down, so 11%.
Listen, Don't math me to death, okay?
So today's movie is 1971's A New Leaf, starring Walter Mondale. Not Walter Mondale. Walter Matthau. Our ex-presidential candidate, Walter Mondale, was in this. He was amazing. I don't know why he didn't win. No. Walter Matthau. And also Elaine May, who we will talk about a lot in this episode. So with me, as always, is my sidekick, Chad.
Hi.
He's kind of like Robin. Not the annoying one, the one you kind of
like. Nightwing. Yeah. Like Nightwing Robin.
No, not that one either. Like the third one.
Oh, that's not Jason Todd. That's who's the third Robin?
Tim Drake?
Tim Drake, thank you.
Yeah, you're Tim Drake.
All right, I'll take Tim Drake. Okay. I'm fine with that.
So today's movie, A New Leaf, this is number 90 on the BBC Top 100 Comedies of All Time list. Chad, would you like to give a little bit of a synopsis of this film?
Sure. So A New Leaf is about Henry Graham. He's this like rich socialite that has no applicable skills. He's just rich and he likes to be rich, and the beginning of the movie is just him finding out that he's not rich anymore. Like, he took all his life savings that he got from his father, his inheritance, and he just blew it. Like, country clubs and croquet on horses and all that stupid blue blood garbage. And so he tells his, you know, servant, like, what's going on, and you know, the servant raises a point, is like, you know, you could just marry into wealth and then you wouldn't have this problem anymore. And he begrudgingly accepts it. So he goes on this quest to find this, you know, rich girl with money that he can marry. And he gets a loan from his uncle that floats him for 6 weeks. And the original bet is if he can, for what is it? $50,000?
$50,000. 1971 money, by the way.
That's a lot of money.
Well, it's a lot of money, but 1971 money is a lot different than today's money. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So, $50,000, if he lands a wife before the 6 weeks is up, he will pay back that loan. Otherwise, like, he just has to give his uncle everything. Henry's not a good person. Like, he's self-absorbed, and he only cares about himself and money. He doesn't care about anybody else. So he gets to, like, what, the 7-day mark, and he meets this rich socialite, Henrietta, at a party. And he's, like, real chivalrous to her. She's like, the complete opposite. She's, you know, a little unkempt. Not that she's not pretty or anything, or not that that's what her character is, but she's a botanist?
Yeah,
she's into ferns, and she's just a scientist, she's really smart, and she's just really, you know, in her own little world. So here comes Henry, you know, trying to, you know, smooge her with, that's not the right word, trying to just, you know, win her over in, like, literally 3 days.
Yeah.
And he's super nice to her, and you know, he asks the right questions. He does all this research. Like, his butler gives him all these books, and he, you know, learns all this stuff. And he ends up marrying her. at the behest of like everybody around Henrietta, like her personal attorney, like just is in love with her and is like, no, you can't do this, and blah blah blah, and he just like, you know, as he like walks her down the aisle, he's like just trying to tell her that he loves her, and she's not hearing it, and blah blah blah, and like they all know why Henry is doing this, and she can't see it because she's in love with him, and so this is where it gets weird for me. So I want to say I really like this movie because of what it did. Because at first, it's really weird. Normally in sitcoms like this, where there's like a competition to get to it, normally the competition would be the entire movie. Like I thought the movie was going to be the whole 6 weeks, and then at the end he was going to find this girl, fall in love, and then everything would be great, and then he would learn a huge lesson about himself, and
right.
That was the end. They fast forward through all that garbage and he gets everything he wants and more. He gets his debt taken care of. Like, she's like, I want all of Henry's debts paid before the wedding. Like, he gets more than he wanted, and he's the bad guy in this situation. So, but then he had to learn all these skills, and yep. Like, he took over her estate. He saw that all her servants were like completely, they weren't being managed, and the person that was managing them was just stealing money. And everybody was onto it. So, like, the first thing he did was fire the whole staff, get new staff in, take care of her finances, make sure, like, she wasn't bleeding money. So, like, he finally, even though he, like, the entire time detests this woman because she's clumsy and she's not, like, a traditional rich person, he, like, he hates that about her. Well, he says it over and over again.
And let's be fair, he detests everybody.
Like, that's true.
He is a bachelor for life. Like, he wants no interaction with anybody. Like, his best friend or whatever is someone who never talks to him.
Yeah, exactly. And now that he's forced to be with this woman, he starts having these, like, these daydreams of her getting killed. And I'm like, okay. At this point in the movie, I'm like, all right, Walter Matthau, Elaine May, I'm curious. And so the entire time, it's really weird. Like, he's getting all the affairs together, presumably because once he did kill her, or does kill her, then all the estate, you know, everything would be in his name, yep. And he wouldn't have any problems. But he learns all these skills, and then she asks him to go on this trip with her to the Adirondacks to look up some specimens. Oh, and real quick, there was a little side story that I really want to mention. Her, when they first met, she said that the only thing that, like, her big claim to fame the only thing she wanted to do was to find a new plant or a fern. A new fern and name it, because then she could be immortalized forever. And later on in the movie, they go to their honeymoon and they end up picking up a fern. She brings it home and finds out that it's new. She gets to name it. And I can't remember the specific name, but she essentially names it after Henry. Like, Henrieticus, Gramicus, you know, whatever the fern's called. And, like, she gives him this little locket, and it has a piece of the fern in it. And he's almost mad at her, because it's up to this point where he's decided to go on this trip, and he's going to try and kill her. And, you know, she's about to die, and her own claim to fame, this fern that could have been her name, is his. And I don't know if he feels guilty or remorse, but later on, they're on the river, and he, just by a stroke of luck, they're going down this waterfall, which I will get back to that in a sec. But they get to a waterfall, they both bail, and she can't swim, so he swims to the edge and is going to leave her there to drown. And then he realizes he lost the locket, and he thinks about, like, you know, she has grounded him in this reality, and he has grounded her, and they need each other. And I think that's what motivates him to go back into the water and save her. Mm-hmm. And that's the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, I was not expecting anything in this movie to be like it was. I was actually really impressed, but I don't know if I really enjoyed that fact, or I don't know if it annoys me because it didn't follow, norms and tropes, but I don't know, like...
I do appreciate the films that break away from the norms and tropes, especially those, like this one, that kind of stand out for other reasons as well. We'll talk about that in a second. But I don't know how much research you did on this one, but this film, the original edit... Well, first of all, Elaine May, this is her directorial debut. She had written some other films, but she's... And this is, I believe, our first female director on the list. Yep. This was her first film, and she is the second star of the film as well.
Yeah.
So she did the editing. So she kind of took on every major role. Her first cut was not only 10 weeks late and over budget, but it was also like 3 hours long. So at that point, the studio took over the film, recut it, and got it to its length. Now, they cut out a lot of the side stories, so I think in her cut, there are a lot of stories. There are more stories about her servants and her lawyer and what they tried to do to kind of get the money and continue to steal the money. And
I was going to say, because they kind of just not give up, but he kind of like tells them, like, it almost seems like you're right, like we missed a bunch, because at the end he's like, look, we had good times, and now it's over.
Yep. Yeah.
And we never hear anything else again.
Yep. So all that was like a longer, bigger story.
That makes sense.
It included, it became a very dark comedy then, because from what I read, there were murders that happened.
Okay.
Not of the two main characters, but there was more about him thinking about killing her. And I think he killed either Mrs. Taggart or Jack Weston, the lawyer, her lawyer.
Yeah.
One of them was killed in it. So it was a much darker ending as well than I think they wanted to go in the 1971 comedy. But so in that regard, I think it was good. I mean, she was obviously not going to be happy about it. She wanted her name off the film, but cooler heads prevailed, so she has her name still attached to the film. But
yeah.
But yeah, so personally, I mean, I liked it as well. I thought it was a good movie, but I don't know if I could have lasted for 3 hours focusing on those servants more and the lawyer. I think that would have been just a little too much.
It's, and especially a comedy too, even a dark comedy, like you can't have a 2-hour comedy. It just, there's never enough substance. And not that, and there's always exceptions to the rule. Like, I think Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead are closer to 2 hours, but like, just traditionally.
Yeah.
But who knows? Like, maybe she secretly was a genius and a 3-hour comedy totally would have worked, but it's just that is not sellable, especially in 1971.
And it's ambitious for any first-time director. I know that she had the story in mind. She wrote it all out. And this is what she wanted to make. I would say for any person that this is their first time directing a major motion picture, that's going to cause a little bit of alarm, especially if the studio doesn't know that if you're bankable or not.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know a lot about the politics or anything like that in the 1971 film era, but I'm guessing there weren't a lot of female directors that were heading and taking all the roles that she did with this film. So I have to give a little bit of kudos. I mean, obviously a lot of kudos to her, because it's a great film, and she went on to direct, I think, 3 or 4 other films. Her last one was Ishtar, which did not do very well.
No.
But she has remained extremely busy in Hollywood. She's a writer, director, actress.
She wrote the screenplay to The Birdcage?
Yes.
That is awesome. I love that movie so much.
Yeah, Birdcage, Heaven Can Wait, the original. Tootsie, uncredited for writing that, which is a great film, which I would not be surprised if that is on here.
I thought I saw it on the list.
Yeah, I think it is. As well as Primary Color. So she's a prolific writer and prolific. I mean, and she has, well, I shouldn't say prolific. She has 11 writing credits, 5 directing credits, and then she's been in 13 movies as an actress. So she's not prolific, but she chooses what she wants to do, which is an amazing power to have in Hollywood, especially being a female.
Can we talk about the different shots that they did? They did a lot of, and they repeated it a few times, but they did a lot of, it's an old trick, because the way lenses work, I'm going to give you a quick film lesson, not you, Chris, but just the three people that are listening. So the way lenses work, they're not like our eyes. Like, our eyes can just adaptively focus on everything. Lenses, you know, you can have a focal plane, and a lot of times, you know, like when you take a picture, if you take a close-up, you see your foreground image and then the background's blurry. It's all dependent on how much light comes through the camera, blah, blah, blah. But an old trick they used to do in Hollywood is they would shoot the foreground, and they would kind of like fudge the lens with Vaseline, or they like fudge the frame, and then they would add in the background, which was shot separately, so then it looked like both planes were in focus. And a couple times in this movie, like when they're on their honeymoon, he's reading the book, The Beginner's Guide to Toxicology, you know, looking up on, you know, toxins. And she's in the background, you know, digging up her fern. And when he meets his uncle for the first time, he's explaining his situation while his uncle just eats a bunch of fruit and, like, you know, pretty much plays into the fact that he's got all the money, he's got all the power, and Henry doesn't. It happens a few times, and it's just it's interesting to see. It's used in old movies, not all the time, but a lot of times where they wanted to get that split focus look, that's how you would do it. So, sorry, that's my...
No!
I just found it, like, especially for a comedy, it's very rare to do... Comedies are shot a specific way. They're pretty easy to shoot and to find, and maybe I should look up the DP, but to find that a comedy from 1971 kind of used that was cool. And I don't know, maybe I should expect it, because this feels like almost like it could be a stage play, and a lot of older movies do to me in general, just because that's what we had for so long before film came along. So it was just a very cool way to, I don't know, the movie not only was good in the sense of the writing and the acting and all that stuff, like the director of photography, they had a lot of jumps in time. Like, when I said, like, you know, I thought the whole movie was going to be him trying to get her to marry him and that would be the end of it. Like, they just fly through everything, through, like, vignettes and, you know, jump cuts, and it's...
Yeah, a lot of footage that was over, that had voiceover on it, kind of explaining what was going on. You know, and I didn't know if some of that had to do with the you know, that it was recut. You know, that they had to grab certain footage and kind of speed up certain parts because they don't want to create a storyline that doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, I could totally see that whole first act being longer. Because he just meets a couple people, he hates them, and then all of a sudden he's, like, on his deadline. And we're not even, like, we weren't even into the second act yet. You're probably right.
So the cinematographer was Gain Rescher. He is known for being the cinematographer for Star Trek II.
Okay.
Shooter, a 1988 film. Murder Me, Murder You, a 1983 film. So I think a lot more, and it's a Mike Hammer film. So I think a lot more, looks like action-y films. Versus, I mean, he did Get Smart. It's a TV movie. But not, you know, I don't see a lot of comedies here.
That's probably why it looks so different, is because they got a a DP that doesn't shoot comedies. And I mean, that could either like kill your movie, or that could be like the best thing ever.
Yeah, I thought there were a lot of interesting shots. I thought, you know, when how things were kind of moved around the room, you know, how the camera movements were and all that, it felt,
yeah,
it felt a little, like you said, play-like, stage-like, but at the same time, it had that realness dimension to it.
You know what? Sorry, finish your thought.
No, go ahead. I was going to change my thought, so go ahead.
I'm almost thinking, now that I know it's 3 hours, I think that beginning makes a lot more sense now, because the beginning was very jarring. Like,
yeah,
immediately, he's getting calls from his lawyer, and it's an emergency, and you know it's about him losing his money, because, you know, I read the log line. But I feel it just felt a little weird that the movie would just immediately start out like that. But now, knowing that the original runtime was 3 hours, it makes a little more sense. And I don't know. Not that the way the movie opens is bad. It's just very... this whole movie is just not traditional in my eyes. Like, it just... and it, again, that's not a bad thing. It's just, it was different, and different is good.
Well, yeah, I think you had somebody, you know, Elaine May, who was... She's outside the studio system, right? And we're coming from an era where the studios ruled the cinema. There were some directors who had power to do what they wanted to do, but it was a lot of men that had made a lot of money for the studios. So you have Elaine May, who is not only female, but she is outside of the studio system. So she kind of, you know, and even today, how many films would someone take that much? I mean, Quentin Tarantino, maybe, but he doesn't do the editing.
No.
You know, like she did every single step of the movie. That's like independent film, almost. Or, you know, it's something that someone who's trying to make a name for themselves would do. It's something we would do.
It's something Kevin Smith did. Like,
yeah. Clerks.
Like, there's very few people out there that can write, direct, and edit.
And act.
And act, yeah, absolutely.
I will go down in saying that he does not act, Kevin Smith. He is not a good actor.
Oh, no,
he
no.
He doesn't try to be. So
no, he.
I'm giving another point to Elaine May.
No, definitely. Plus, I don't think she had a stroke, so.
That's true. Yeah. So this was our first, and I imagine not our last, Walter Matthau movie. My experience with Walter Matthau, like I remember seeing him in films, some films growing up, particularly Grumpy Old Men and Grumpier Old Men, and I always enjoyed watching him in films. I always thought he was a fun character in films because, like, he always has that sleepy look to him. So when he kind of like brightens up and all that, it's immediately funny. You know, it's kind of like the opposite of the people who have like the bug eyes.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed it. I mean, it was different because I still pictured him as the grumpy old man. So, you know, more of just a retiree. I mean, and he looked older in this film. Not the grumpier old man, but he looked older than I would have thought he was in 1971. He would have been 51 when this film was made. But yeah, I enjoyed it a lot. I enjoyed his performance. I don't know what you thought of it, but I mean, he was, and sorry, I keep asking you questions and then I keep talking, which is rule number one for good podcasting, right? he had a big name. He was the big name of this film by far.
Yes.
I mean, he had the Odd Couple had come out, 3 years prior to this, so he was well known for being a go to comedic actor. It'd be like bringing in I don't know. I can't even think of a comedian actor right now. Like that would be around him. I enjoyed him. What did you think?
I didn't realize he was in the Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. I like Walter Matthau. I'm just kind of like scrolling through everything. I didn't realize him and Jack Lemmon like did every other movie with each other.
Oh yeah, they were like Martin and all the other guys, like Bob Hope and Dean Martin, yeah. and all that. Like they were a pair, and I think that was pretty common back then, is to have the pair that could act off each other so well.
I mean, The Rock and Kevin Hart are in every other movie with each other, so
I would go to say that they can act off each other pretty well. Like Kevin Hart is he can react off him. I mean, look at all the partners Owen Wilson has in all his films. Yeah. In his heyday, you know, he had Ben Stiller, Jackie Chan, and he can act off of either one of them, very different actors, and still be funny.
Yeah, I remember Walter Matthau. The first time I saw him was Dennis the Menace.
Okay.
The 91 reboot. He was the neighbor, Mr. Wilson. I mean, and I watched that movie all the time because my brother liked watching that movie. But my favorite Walter Matthau movie is definitely The Bad News Bears. Like, as the drunk coach.
Yes.
Coach Buttermaker. Like... He just that oh man, I wish that was on this list. That'd be a good movie. But yeah, I guess I'm not a Walter Matthau, you know, fanatic. But he's everything I've seen him in. He's a professional. He's good. He plays. He's really good at his timing, and his flow.
Yeah, I think so. I think that. That's perfect. I mean, and I think when you work with a partner so often, that's enhanced.
Yeah. Right?
Because you know, like, Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau knew each other so well that they could just bounce off each other and it'd be great. I'm not sure. I think there probably is another Walter Matthau film on the list, but I can't say for sure. So a couple other surprise... actors that were in this film. One was Doris Roberts.
I was gonna say, I didn't realize that was her until I was looking through this list.
It's like, holy cow,
Mrs. Taggart, or Traeger.
Yeah, but she had a little spunk to her. Like, she was,
the winking?
Yeah, the winking and all that. It's like, oh, you're Raymond's mother.
Well, and then that led me to believe, I'm like, wow, is Henry... Like, is that what's going to bring Henry down? Like, up to this point, he has, like, been on the straight and narrow path, and he's married, and, you know.
Yeah.
But then, no, like, he knocked the door down. He fired them all.
Yeah, he did. He cleaned house. And then the other surprise person that I saw on this was Mr. Drummond, Conrad Bain. He has an uncredited role. He played Mr. Drummond in Different Strokes. He was one of the wedding guests early on. And I think he was probably in the bigger movie that was kind of cut down.
Huh. I don't remember seeing him.
Yeah, he was... I think he may have been that weird girl's dad. Remember, like,
okay.
He's getting ready, getting dressed, and she walks in. Like, where's the bathroom? Like, I'm going to kill you. Like, where is all this from?
He was so mean to that girl.
I know, and like we didn't have the story of like why he was. I mean, I'm imagining that was in the other film.
Yeah.
Why he was angry at her, because he was very angry at her. And but yeah, so he was in it. Conrad Bain. I was surprised to see him in there, because I mean he wasn't down the credit line because he barely had a role in it. I don't even know if he had a line.
No, I don't remember him speaking.
Another favorite, a great character actor, Jack Weston is in this. So what has he been? He was in,
Dirty Dancing.
Dirty Dancing. I like when they have it, like, on IMDb, they always have, like, like, they're most known for it. Maybe a bit role, but this is the most famous movie that they're in. But he was in a number of movies that you look at him, it's like, I remember him from somewhere.
He was in Short Circuit 2. Okay, now I know where he was from. I think he was one of the bad guys. Yeah, Oscar. He was Oscar. Oscar bad. Oh my God. How did I not figure that out? Sorry.
No, it's okay. This is why we do this. He was on Bewitched.
He was on Gunsmoke. He's an old dude.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he's dead.
Yeah, he had a long career, but a very distinguished career. Like you look at his face and you recognize him and you're not sure from what. But then you look at all the films and all the TV shows that he was in, it's like, okay, again, another working actor, somebody in Hollywood who is able to make a living doing this, and not a one-hit wonder. Yeah, he didn't, he may not have had his leading man role, but hey, you know what? If he can get cast in as much as he's been cast in, starting his career in the early 50s, going through the, 1988 was his last appearance. So that's a pretty good life.
Wow, yeah. He was a TV actor for a long time. Like, he was on the Ten Commandments movie.
Who it's wasn't? Everybody was in that one. But yeah, so I think a very enjoyable film. I think one that is impressive for it'd be impressive for anyone to take on all the roles that Elaine May did, and to not only come in over budget and late and turn in a 3-hour comedy, but it was regarded well enough that she got more work. that she wasn't like done after that. They didn't say, okay, we tried it, you messed up, or we weren't happy with it. What they got, they liked. So yeah, absolute huge credit to her. I think we both enjoyed this film. I think we both would recommend watching it. It's one of those that it's just there's a lot of one-liners that are it's funny. Like, what is it, like grease on the intake valve? That's what he's always told, or why his car is breaking down.
And then later on, something else breaks down that's not a car, and that's what the explanation is.
Yeah, and I like so in the. We're about to wrap this up, but I have to, like, when you first see this film, the opening scene, you have all these white coats, and you hear the heart monitor, beep, 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 and it's a voiceover of Walter Matthau just saying, like, is everything okay? Is it going to make it? Is he going to make it? Or is she going to make it? Is she going to make it? And it turns out he's going to these high-priced mechanics that just look like they're dressed like doctors.
Yeah, and white coats.
And he badly drives his Ferrari.
And he has to take it in, like, every week.
Every week, every 2 weeks, because he just ruins it. Oh, yeah. It's a great start to a movie, because it gets that character right away. So,
I like the, just to piggyback off the beginning, after that, when he finally realizes he loses, he has no money, after he has, like, a stupid conversation with his lawyer about what capital is. It's really funny.
Yeah.
And then he just kind of like walks outside and he hears birds in the air, even though there's none around. And it's like a surreal moment. And then we follow him for like 5 minutes going to all his favorite places, like the restaurant. And they're like, oh, hey, what's going on? And he's like, nothing. Just wanted to see her one last time. And they're like, okay, well, we'll be here. And he just goes everywhere just to, like,
just say goodbye.
Say goodbye.
And, like, giving, like, hypotheticals, like, well, if I were out of money, what would you do?
Yeah. Oh, we'd kick you out.
Okay, well, I'm not, but, yeah, so it was, like, it's an enjoyable movie. It's not, I mean, the only thing that I really saw that was dated in it was the money. Like being crazy rich in 1971 is very different from being crazy rich today.
Yeah.
He was spending $200,000 a month or something like that.
And
overdrafting, and yeah, that's a lot of money. I'm not trying to say it's not a lot of money. But for what he was getting, like his Ferrari was $15,000. Brand new Ferrari.
Brand new Ferrari. It's worth 15.5. I'm like, what? Yeah.
So a little bit different money back then. I think it'd be probably $1 million a month he was spending in today's world. And the Ferrari would cost what a Ferrari costs, which I don't know because I don't look that up. So, yeah. Go ahead.
I don't have a small enough penis to drive a Ferrari yet. No. So.
No. Bugatti, maybe, but Ferrari, no.
Yeah.
All right. So any last thoughts on A New Leaf?
A New Leaf? No. I liked it. It was good. It was different. Not different like The Exterminating Angel, which was like a whole level of different. A New Leaf was cool because it, like, I can sit down, and I'm sure you can too, Chris, and you can sit down when a movie first starts and you see the beginning seeds of what the story's going to be and you kind of like play it out in your head. 9 times out of 10, I can play that out with any movie I've never seen, but this one, it kept me like wondering. Like, and I knew, no, I didn't. I'm going to stick to my guns. Like, I didn't know if in the end he was going to kill her or not.
Yeah.
Which is weird because normally I can figure that out. And... because the entire time he never showed any remorse of how he was feeling or like she did something cute today. Oh, maybe I can like her. Like there was none of that. Like the entire time he had his objective. And yep. When push came to shove, he got everything he wanted. Everything fell into his lap. Even like trying to kill her, he didn't have to do anything except walk away. Like he could just say, oh yeah, she drowned because she didn't know how to swim and I couldn't save her. But in the end, I think he realized that he found a purpose because of her, because it made him, like, learn how to handle the finances and how to just be a person.
Yeah, he had to grow up.
He had to grow up. They're both kids the entire time. Like, as much as they want to be adults, they're both children. And in the end, I think he realizes that because they're both children, that they do need each other. So, I like that. I like that I could actually watch a movie and not guess 90% of the plot before the second act, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you. Like, I wasn't sure if he was going to kill her or not because he kept looking up poisons. He kept going to the gardener to see if he had any poisonous fertilizers. And no, she's all organic. Oh.
He play out scenarios in his head.
Yeah,
like...
it's a good film. It's a good film. And I think we would both recommend to watch it. It is G-rated. Because it is 1971, so a lot safer. All right, so our next film.
Daisies.
Daisies, a 1966 film out of Czechoslovakia.
I'm pretty sure the last name's Chitilova? Chitilova?
Yeah, Vera Chitilova. So our second female director, right back to back. So we're getting two female directors in a row. So, I've never heard of this film, and I hope we can find it. That's going to be the hard part. So, if we don't find it anywhere...
I'm sure we'll find it.
Well, we'll do our best. But the you know, so that will be number... We're going to break into the 80s, Chad. Are you ready?
We're doing the 80s.
Not that 80s.
Oh.
Sorry.
Darn it.
Yeah, there's actually only one film from the 80s in the 80s. That's surprising. I'm
trying to see how many movies I've seen that are in the 80s.
Yeah, so the next 10 films that we'll be doing, so the New Leaf starts a new 10. So we have Daisies, then Zoolander.
Love it.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which is a Howard Hawks film. Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Never heard of it.
1949 film. Amarcord. Our first Fellini film, a famous Italian director. Then we have Waiting for Guffman.
Love it.
Which is a Christopher Guest take on a famous play.
What's the play called?
Waiting for...
Garfield.
Yes. I can't remember the name. Safety Last, which is our silent... I believe that is our silent film.
I mean, it's 1923.
Yeah, I think
probably
it has
will
to be.
Be.
Followed by Top Secret. So 2 exclamation point films in a row.
Oh, man.
And then there's something about Mary, and that will bring us to our last of our next 10. So that's our next section.
All right.
We go from 1923 all the way to 1998. Or 2001. Sorry, 2001. Zoolander. So, yeah. So a good start to our next 10.
Yeah, I'm excited. I've seen half of these, so
any that you can say, any that you can say, I don't have to watch that because I've seen it so many times.
I think at one point I could say Zoolander, but because it's been such a long time since I've seen it, I want to watch it.
Yeah.
Top Secret, I've only seen once. Waiting for Guffman, I've only seen once. There's Something About Mary. Yeah, I'd have to rewatch that. My mom loved that movie when it came out. And Brett Favre is in that movie. I remember that.
That's true. Brett Favre is in it. We'll have a special hour-long episode with that one. I'll work with our intern, see if they can get Brett Favre on that podcast.
Oh, man. If they could get Favre, that'd be great.
I think we may actually get bumped up to 10 listeners then.
If we got Brett Favre, we definitely would have the Packer fans.
Yeah, they would all listen. Oh, I wonder if we could get, if any of our listeners are Brett Favre impersonists, let us know. You might be on this podcast.
Don't show us your penis.
Yes. All right. Chad, any final thoughts that you'd like to share?
No, I've said what I needed to say.
Okay, well, I have one last thought.
Oh, you jerk.
Lord loves a working man. Don't trust Whitey. See a doctor and get rid of it. Thank you, everybody. Till next time.
Later.
The Filmological Society is a production of Redacted Media in association with Ghosthead Media. For more information, find us on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter, or visit us at www.ghosthead.net.